reaching part four. I'm trying to break this up into bite-sized chunks. I've been realizing I'm kind of thinking maybe 25 minutes is about as long as any individual sort of chapter of this should be. And I do encourage you to go back and look through the slides and really think about the ideas. Because these ideas I'm presenting to you are the ones that, if you like, permaculture is built on. And it's built to say on observations. I'm not really trying to argue a case for these things. I'm encouraging you to bring these ideas into your own perspective and to your own work and look around and see, can you see the evidence that supports these ideas around you? You know, and all I've done really is all these photos is I've walked around various places that I've got to visit as I've looked at things, and I started to see them through this idea, this lens, if you like, of natural principles. So we were looking up into the canopy of a tropical forest there, looking at the succulents dropping their roots down. I'm going to move on to the next slide, which is called Stacking in Guerra's Garden. So this is a very old picture, actually. The first generation of permaculture designers in the UK was a guy called Mike Guerra. He was a designer. And this is a small back garden in a sort of suburban townhouse on the edge of London. And he got this idea of stacking, what we were talking about in the previous slide, the idea of thinking about how nature's systems are three-dimensional and dynamic and changing and exploring edges and surfaces and things growing on things and within things. Well, he took that idea to the kind of, you know, to the max. He asked himself, how much stuff can I stack into a space? How much productivity can I get into a small space? So we're seeing he's got raised beds to increase the soil depth and the fertility. He's got layering. We can see plants operating at different layers. We've got ground cover plants. We've got shrubs. We've got maybe small trees at the sides there. We're seeing climbers. He's got lots of beans and pumpkins and things climbing away. Again, opportunistic plants that will grab light wherever it is. We've got plants in containers. We've got plants in hanging baskets. We've got hanging baskets hanging off the hanging baskets. And as a designer, he kind of set himself the question, and it's a fun question within permaculture, as we say, where is the upper limit to productivity? Is it that we can always be adding another species? Is there always another niche that we could create? Get a little frog pond or a fish pond, or can we get another layer into our stacked system? Now, in the temperate world, in the sort of more cooler, damper climates that we have certainly here in the UK, is the limiting factor in the systems is sunlight. And that when we do stack systems, we have to think very carefully about which way the light and the sunlight is coming from, where the shadows are, because the sun obviously is much lower in the sky and much less strong. If you happen to be on the equator, then you've got sort of different set of challenges, if you like, different set of limiting factors, where sometimes the sun is too strong. And for some of these plants wouldn't survive unless they were shaded under trees or under shade netting. So again, think about how we can grow in systems, how we can build relationships between elements, where the existence of one plant or one system could help create the conditions for another. That's design. That's what we're trying to get to. And we're trying to have some fun with that. So one of the principles behind this that Bill Mollison gave us right at the beginning of the permaculture concept is the yield of a system is theoretically unlimited. I mean, that's a pretty mind-blowing statement. But when you think about, you know, if you go into Mabira Forest in Uganda, or you go into tropical rainforest in South America, whatever it is, you see really thousands of species interacting in this really huge, dynamic, three-dimensional system. Hundreds of different species. And so the idea was that maybe the only limit on the number of uses of a resource is the limit of the information or imagination of the designer. So maybe you're the limiting factor. It's your imagination. To think about how many different yields, how we can use things in different ways, how we can create these synergistic, symbiotic relationships. This is a challenge, you know. It's just like a challenge to see how far can we go. So, symbiosis again. He was seeing a termite mound in the crook of a tree. The termites, to protect themselves probably from being eaten by birds, to protect themselves probably from the hot climate there, build little clay tunnels. You can see them on the underside of the branches. And they run up and down inside these clay tunnels, patrolling the tree, driving off predators, harvesting their food. And I was fascinated by this. One was this sort of complex, intimate relationship between the termites and the tree. Does the termite regard the tree as part of its own domain, part of its own world? Where's the hard line between the world of the termites and the world of the tree? And we've seen examples of this before. But I was fascinated by these little clay tunnels that they run up and down in within. It made me think, well, it's just like our arterial system, the way that our blood circulates. And isn't it interesting how nature recreates the same patterns again and again in different ways? Maybe something that works in one context can work in another context. So there's another very interesting idea from within permaculture, right, is how can we emulate nature? What can we, what's the term they use? Biomimicry. Can we copy and learn from nature systems and apply them to our own design systems? And for sure we can. There's nature is rich with ideas and insights into how things can work and into patterns and so much. So again, another part of the symbiosis, if that's mutually beneficial relationship, isn't just between the tree and the termite, but it's between the tree and us. It's teaching us. It's showing us possibilities. And it's also producing its different yields. Okay. So couple more principles from sort of Mollison's thinking, which is components placed in a system need to be viewed relatively, not in isolation, because functional relationships exist between those components. So in other words, just looking at the termite or just looking at the tree, we're failing to see the connection between the two. That in some strange way in nature, it seems that everything's connected to everything else. So we need to recognize what these functional elements are, functional relationships are between the various elements. I'll give a really simple example. It was an interesting one that Paul Stamets gave us. Paul Stamets is a leading mycologist in America, a guy who studies mushrooms. And at Yellowstone National Park there, they have these thermal lakes. They get very, very hot from geothermal energy heat. And we get what we call a geyser. So it fills up with water, the crack, the water boils, and suddenly it squirts up into the air and you get these fantastic effects. But he noticed that there were some grasses that were growing within this hot water. And he knew that the water was hotter than the grass would normally be able to tolerate. And he thought that's really interesting. So he took the grasses into the laboratory and tried to cultivate them in a sterile laboratory situation. And what he quickly realized was that the grasses were contaminated. There was a fungi growing within them. So that he could understand the data properly, they removed the fungi and just cultivated the grass by itself. Well, interestingly and bizarrely, is the grass then lost its thermal tolerance. It lost its ability to grow in hot springs. And it realized with the revealing that this ability for the plant to live in this very hostile environment actually came from its functional relationship with the fungi. So everything's connected, and there's all sorts of different things going on that we might not be aware of. So we have to learn. This is why the observation bit is so important. So let's think about diversity. So if we start with bare rock, we might end up with a forest. It might take thousands of years, hundreds of years, but that's what's going to happen. So as a general rule, we could say that as systems mature, natural systems mature, they become increasingly diverse. And they become diverse in space and time. In other words, they have many more different species. They become more diverse in their shape, the space they occupy, and also in terms of the timelines of the organisms living within them. Some just living for minutes or hours, some living for centuries or millennia. But what's important is not just the complexity, but it's the functional relationships that exist between those elements. So rather than obsessing about how many elements we have in a system, we realize the really important thing is how those things are relating to each other. And that often is what gives natural systems their strength and their dynamism, and what often we fail to achieve in farm systems because we don't embrace diversity and functional relationships between species in the same way that we get in nature. And I think that's central. Okay, so now we're looking at a piece of rainforest. Again, this is in Tobago, in the tropical Caribbean island of Tobago, just off the coast of Venezuela. What we're seeing here is a three-dimensional dynamic stacked system. This is what nature likes to do when it's left to its own devices. And interestingly, in Tobago, they have one of the oldest, or the oldest, tropical forest reserves in the world. They realized that when colonials were chopping it all down 200 years ago or so, that the process of removing the forest meant they lost the soils and it stopped raining. And so they created a forest reserve within the island for the purpose of the ecology to remain to function. But let's have a look. Let's explore this system. Well, we've got some big, tall canopy trees. We can see trees reaching up, taller than everything else. There are other shorter trees underneath them, understory trees. We've got palm trees as well. And again, exploring different niches. I bet you there's clumping plants and bamboos and taro and vines growing within there too. We can certainly see climbers covering every surface. This is nature doing everything it can to catch and store energy. It is photosynthesize. Grab every little bit of that solar energy, not just by having a one or two dimensional crop like a field of maize, but by mixing together different kinds of plants, different angles, with different needs, different life cycles, different timelines. And that means that this system is kind of optimized to get the most out of it at any time, all year round. And again, there's an archetype. There's a basic pattern here, which we might want to really think about bringing into our own design and relationship to nature. So I think if we're going to sort of summarize some of our principles that we've been talking about, is nature catches and stores energy. We look at this forest system, we realize it's built entirely out of what was there already. Okay, excluding maybe what's blown in, rivers, streams trickle in, a certain amount of material might blow in from the outside, come in with rain, bird droppings, this new genetic material arriving all the time through the interaction with other animals and elements in the system. But essentially, this system is using the energy that's there from the sun. It's pulling the minerals out of the soil. It's combining those together to create a living system, and in turn, building up a fertile, complex soil and ecosystem. So it's built out of what was there already. So there's a challenge to you as a permaculture designer: is the materials that you need to use are the ones that are under your feet. Look around. What's there? If there's plenty of stone, you're going to be building out of stone. If there's plenty of wood, let's work with wood. So we've got scrap metal, where it comes from kind of urban environment. There's all sorts of other resources lying around that we could utilize to create productivity, to catch and store energy, to build soils, to create habitats for plants to photosynthesize, and then plants that we can then feed to other elements of the system to start building our productivity. These are very, very important ideas. And I think if we were going to add one more to this observation, is that this system absolutely minimizes and excludes the idea of waste. Anything within there that dies is going to get eaten, redigested, reincorporated back into the system very, very quickly. You can imagine maybe a monkey passing through the system. It might die for some reason. By the time it's hit the ground, it's already been digested, perhaps by other mammals, perhaps by ants, perhaps by fungi. But very, very quickly, the carcass of that animal would be reincorporated back into the system, by the plants and the trees and the fungi that surround it. So these systems are very, very good at being efficient, working with natural and local resources, and of excluding waste. So, are you getting the picture? These are the kinds of things, processes that we want to bring into permaculture design. The next slide is of a landfill site in just south of London. It's a place called Croydon. This is the Beddington landfill site, and it's I got to work there for some. I was supporting a TV series actually, and I spent nearly a month there. And it, I've seen landfill sites before, but being there for a month blew my mind, because what I then realized was what you're looking at is a pile of rubbish that's 120 feet high. And what they do is they cap it off by they put a layer of rubbish, and then they put a layer of clay of subsoil on top of that, and then they build another layer on top of it until it's 120 feet high. And that's like a mountain of trash, and it's covering 40 acres of what had been a quarry, a place where they dug stone out of the ground. 40 acres, 120 feet high, and that's just the rubbish from South London. What's the next generation going to think of us? Because we weren't doing it right. If you're producing that much rubbish, this is the next thing, was thinking about waste and the nature of waste is, see the size of that lorry? That's as big as a lorry is allowed to be and drive on the UK roads. It's as high, tall, long, heavy as it can possibly be. And when we were there from 6 a.m. in the morning till 5 p.m. at night, there was a line of those lorries coming in every day, non-stop. Each one of those drivers, I don't know, let's say he's on £30,000 a year or 20, I don't know what they've no idea what they're paid. But he's got insurance. He's there's the truck. We'll think what the truck costs, think of the diesel in the truck, think how many tires they might get through, the maintenance of that. And you start to realize is, wow, we spend millions, if not billions, on throwing stuff away. And yet we talk about scarcity and shortages, we talk about our concerns for the environment, and yet the very heart of certainly the Western economy, we're seeing it more and more around the globe, the very heart of our economy is using stuff up once and sending it somewhere else and chucking it away. And that's just nuts. And the next generation, future generations, will look back at us and go, what were you thinking? Because a lot of those things that we're throwing away are precious natural resources that we only ever get once. Think how many, computers and cell phones, oh, da, 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 I don't know what. There's so many things that we're using, and they're not having a long lifespan, and they're just then getting chucked away. A lot of what goes into landfill is building materials from old buildings, but also the packaging from shop-bought materials, and really just it's not good. It's not good. This is what humans do when we step outside of the rules of ecology, is we create a mess. So I want to contrast that with how nature deals with its mess. And this hole in the ground that we're looking at in the next slide is actually, it was a composting toilet. It's a system that we sometimes use called a crap tractor, or however, whatever euphemism you'd like to use. And what we do is we put a cabin over the hole. We use that as a toilet. Every time we have used it, we maybe backfill with a little bit of soil. And when the hole's nearly full, we put the topsoil back and we can plant a tree in it. That's a zero waste system. That's managing human waste, potentially could carry disease, but in a safe way. Okay. We also tried versions of this system where instead of backfilling with soil, we backfill with organic matter so that the decomposition, composting happens in the soil where it's safe and away from where it could spread disease. And if we move to the next slide, you can see what you get is a really nice, rich compost out of it. This one actually used pine needles, which break down very slowly. I'd left this material in the ground. I dug it out with a spade, and there was absolutely nothing that was unpleasant about it. There was nothing about it that made me think about, oh, This was toilet waste. It just looked and smelt and behaved like compost. So, and there's the giant peach that I fed my peach tree with that same compost, and it gave me a bumper harvest of fruits. So trying to think about the relationship, the difference between throwing waste or stuff away and causing a mess that future generations will not thank us for, or using waste in a creative way in which we can support growing, you know, productive systems. Okay, so the next slide is of a small church. This again is in Wales. It's near to where I live, and I took this photo in the afternoon of a day where it had been very cold and very frosty, and you can see on the right hand side of the building of the church there is a triangle of snow or frost on the ground, and even though it's a bright sunny day, that piece of land has not thawed out. And that's because it's in the shadow of the church. And you can see as the sun has gone across the sky during the course of the day, the frost or the snow that was probably covering all of that ground has melted, except for the bit in the shadow of the church that isn't getting the sunshine on. So this is a bit about differences. It's about microclimate. We use the word microclimate, and I think it's a very important term to bring on board. And that is, well, okay, the weather of that day is what it was. It was a cold, bright, sunny day. But on the one side of the church, it would have been really warm because the sun was shining, even though the air was cold. On the other side of the church, on the frosty side, the ground didn't even thaw out during the course of that day. So we've got a warm side and we've got a cold side. That might be the same for how water is trapped in the system. There might be a wet side and a dry side, or a side that's sheltered from the wind and a side that's exposed. Sometimes the difference of a few inches or a foot or two can be the difference between whether a plant or something is going to succeed or not succeed. And actually, sometimes as gardeners, as with a permaculture mindset, is we try and create microclimates, positive microclimates, differences, so that not all of our crops become ripe at the same time. We get a longer season. We might want more diversity. We might not just want one kind of crop. And again, we can do that by exploring microclimates, the shelter of the wall, the windward side, the leeward side, the sunny side, the cold side, and so forth. And I end up saying, realizing, and one of the things I sort of say, because it comes from a realization, is that never underestimate how important microclimate is. And really pay attention. Look at the land around you that you're working with, that you're trying to design or manage or farm, and understand the differences between one side and the other, the top and the bottom, the left and the right. There'll be differences, and you can work to those, you can turn those to your advantage, but only if you're paying attention and you've noticed them in the first place. Okay? Microclimate. I probably need to find more African examples of these things, perhaps, for people looking at some other contexts, but we've got plenty of time on this course, and you'll see a lot of different slides of different examples. So, we've touched now on succession. I want you to be happy with these terms, right? Succession. Stacking. The idea that natural systems are three-dimensional. So when we talked about no waste, we're going to use the word cycling. Natural systems cycle resources. They don't use them. They transform them. So it might be soil, and then it becomes part of a tree, then it becomes part of the leaf, then it becomes part of the food system for a bird, which then ultimately becomes part of the soil again. You think about how those molecules cycle endlessly through the system. We talked about beneficial relationships, symbiosis, that actually nature's really typified by these mutually beneficial, very interesting dynamic partnerships. We talked about the importance of diversity and how that gives us a chance to harvest every part of the system. We touched on microclimate, local and biological resources, And in the next session, I'm going to talk about multiple functions and multiple elements. Key ideas of permaculture. And I hope you enjoyed this segment and found it useful. Thank you very much for listening.